This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, sitting in for Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. With voters focused on a chaotic presidential election, a hotly contested U.S. Senate matchup, and a wide-open race for governor, it's not surprising that the battle for control of the New Hampshire State Senate goes largely unnoticed. Yet, with 8 state Senate seats, fully one-third of the body's total membership being vacated, Democrats and Republicans are girding for a struggle over party control. The outcome could have big implications for the next governor, as the small legislative chamber has had an outsized impact on most of the big policy debates in New Hampshire, including Medicaid expansion, death penalty repeal, business tax cuts, marijuana decriminalization, and much more. We'll discuss why the seats are being vacated, who the leading contenders to fill them are, and the likelihood that each party will control the chamber next January. Today on The Exchange, it's the race for the state Senate. Let's hear from you. You can call into The Exchange at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange, all one word. And I have 4 guests joining me in studio for the program this morning. Daniel Barrick. Dan is NHPR Senior Editor for Politics and Public Policy Reporting. And Dan, it's good to see you.
Hey, Dean.
Peter Bragdon. He's a former Republican state senator from the 11th District in the Amherst and Merrimack area, and he served as Senate president from December of 2010 to August of 2013. And Senator Bragdon, thanks so much for joining us this
morning.
Great
to be here. Thank you.
And Kevin Landrigan. Kevin is senior reporter for the New Hampshire Union Leader. Kevin, it's always good to see you.
Thanks, Dean.
And Jeff Woodburn. He's a Democratic state senator from District 1 in the North Country and currently serves as Senate Minority Leader. And Senator Woodburn, thanks for joining us as well.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Gentlemen, let's begin by giving listeners kind of a brief overview of the state Senate in terms of size, role it typically plays in state government, partisan makeup, et cetera. And Dan Barrick, let me turn to you first. I know that you and NHPR have been doing a lot of reporting on this. How would you characterize this chamber to someone who is not really familiar with it?
Well, it's one of two chambers in the state house, the House and the Senate. It's, as you mentioned, 24 members, which is really quite a bit smaller than the 400-member House,
right.
Which is notable. But also that smaller size means that, you know, personal relationships and the ability to negotiate really play a big role in how legislation gets through there. It's currently now – it's got a 14-10 Republican majority. But the chamber has flipped back and forth quite a bit in the last 10 or 12 years between the two parties' control. And as you mentioned, with 8 vacancies this year, including a majority of those vacancies are actually in the small handful of true swing districts or, you know, districts that really are up for grab, there's a good chance that there's going to be a lot of change and turnover and possibly be a change in the leadership. So we've been focusing on it, you know, as you said, because of just it's been getting so little attention in this busy political season. But the chance and the likelihood that this chamber will see some real churn and the outside sway that the Senate has had really for a long time, but especially in recent history, in shaping major policy outcomes, the state budget, Medicaid expansion, a lot of those things were really lived or died by what happened in the Senate. So it's really going to – what happens in November the election for the state Senate may well be the most significant series of elections in terms of on-the-ground policy and politics for New Hampshire.
Now, Kevin, people are often surprised to hear that we've got a House with 400 representatives but a Senate with only 24. You've been covering the state House for many years. Your initial thoughts on that particular chamber?
Well, I mean, the Senate is often an overlooked body. And why is that? Because it's not the House, which is the third largest body in the free world, right? And we know about the House. I mean, Peter Bragdon laughed. He served in the House. So many state senators served in the House before. They know the type of place it is. It's quixotic. It's unpredictable. It's hopelessly Democratic with a small D. Its members will not tolerate the inability to speak whenever they want to. The Senate, by contrast, is an extremely choreographed organization. 24 members, one of the smallest legislative bodies in the country. And as such, it requires bipartisan work. It also requires a lot of planning. I kind of refer to them both as The House is a proactive body and the Senate is a reactive body. And I don't mean that the Senate doesn't initiate things when it comes to the budget, tax cuts, workers' comp reform. The Senate, on major issues, the Senate often leads, but they're reactive in this way. Every year in the middle of the year, we have crossover when all bills from one chamber go to another chamber. And in the Senate, I don't care if the leadership's Democrat or Republican, the reaction is the same. What the heck is this? Meaning, what has the House sent us? And that's what I mean by reactive. So the Senate often has to take very controversial issues, issues that a governor may not want of either party, and dispense with them, often kill them, but more just as often neuter them and make them politically palatable.
Now, Senator Bragg and Kevin mentioned that you actually were a representative as well. And Senator Woodburn, you did at least a term in the House,
yes,
a long time, a while ago, correct? Yep. Okay, let me turn to both of you and get your sense of why this very small chamber seems to play such a big role in government. In particular, as Dan Barrick mentioned, it really always seems to be at the center of budget negotiations for a variety of reasons. And I'll start with you, Senator Bragdon.
Well, I think, you know, obviously the House and the Senate play two key roles, and one's not more important than the other. I do think that at some points it does look like the Senate is taking the lead. But like the state budget, for instance, the Senate gets the second crack at it, and it gets the second crack at it after more revenue numbers have come in. So we have more information available to us, and we're looking at it later in the game. And so it does many times look like the Senate is taking the lead on budget stuff, when in reality, for the prior several months, the House has been working on it. So in some ways, it's a matter of perception as well. And especially, I think, with a shrinking media core at the State House, it's, as Kevin said, the House can sometimes seem very chaotic, whereas the Senate, there's just a small number of people there that really, you know, with 24 members, you only need 13 votes to pass anything. So it's a small number of people that you can reach out to get a feel for what's going on. So I think both bodies are important, but they are very different.
Senator Woodburn.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think the one other observation that hasn't come up here is that increasingly running for the Senate has become a much more professional operation. You have to balance interest. You have to raise money. And that requires a certain amount of political sophistication. In the House, you can basically – a lot of these cases, you just put your name on the ballot. You don't have to run. You don't have to appeal to interest. You can either be far left, far right, or anything in between. But you do have to compromise. You do have to work together. And I think those that enjoy the Senate are those that like to compromise, like to get the process moving, either to pass legislation they believe is important or to mitigate some of the potential of legislation that just needs to be focused a little bit more or moderated a little bit more. And I think those who are on the extreme tend to be frustrated by the process because it is very collegial. You can't – in the House, you can criticize a member. You can get personal. I mean, everything in the Senate we know in advance pretty much. There's surprises here and there, but by and large, we know where people stand on the votes. It's not hard to count to 13, and that makes the process much more quieter, much more collegial. The speeches do not generally make a difference on the outcome.
So both of you having run for House and Senate, the suggestion is that you have more of kind of a political and professional identity running for Senate than if you run for House, you're just kind of either a Republican or a Democrat on the ballot? Is that your experience?
And neither that. I mean, when I ran for the House, I was chairman of the school board. So, you know, you have a lot of local knowledge.
So it's not even party-driven necessarily?
Yeah, to a much lesser degree, I think. So I agree with Jeff that it's got to be the broader interest you serve being elected by, you know, 50,000 people versus 3,000. You know, you've got – it forces more moderation, and you generally can't be too far to the left or the right and still appeal to that broader spectrum.
We're talking about the race for the New Hampshire State Senate today. You can call in at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter. I have four guests with me in studio today. NHPR's Dan Barrick, former Republican State Senator and Senate President Peter Bragdon, Union Leader reporter Kevin Landrigan, and current Democratic State Senator and Minority Leader Jeff Woodburn. And gentlemen, let's go to the phones, and we have Steve joining us from Nottingham. Steve, welcome to the exchange.
Good morning, and thank you very much for doing this show. One of the things that has bothered me in all the elections is that you have correctly identified that the national and the state Senate and governor get a lot of attention, and the locals don't. And that's – I want to give a shout-out to what they call ultra-local journalism. And I'm part of a newspaper called The Forum, which covers Candia, Northwood, Deerfield, and Nottingham. The reason we came into being is that we actually cover the House and the Senate race. We have special print editions which focus on those because they don't get the publicity. And if you believe that an educated electorate is a bulwark of democracy, this is the type of program you're doing and we're doing that gets the word out about the local candidates, mm-hmm. not the national.
Well, thanks, Steve, for that call. And let me turn to our two reporters. And Dan Barrick, I'll start with you. You've done, as Kevin has, presidential reporting, but also sort of hyper-local reporting. Your response to Steve's comments?
Well, I think he's right. And I believe it was Senator Bragdon mentioned it as well. I mean, the size of the press corps within the State House has shrunk pretty significantly in the last decade. The size of the local media, regional papers, and radio outlets has shrunk just in terms of staffing, which means just fewer resources to devote to the kind of vetting that in a healthy democracy should be happening of House and Senate candidates, vetting not only of you know, just who are they, what have they, are they who they've said they are, but really pulling out the nuances of what their positions would be. So, and this is not a New Hampshire specific problem, this is a national problem, but it's a real challenge to help voters kind of connect to their potential representatives.
Yeah, Kevin?
Yeah, one of the issues too with a lot of these state senate districts is that there's no major media market, you know, and to Steve's point, so you rely on a lot of adjunct journalists to do some of the reporting for these elections. There's some races we're going to talk about, certainly. You know, a good one is over in the Seacoast, District 24, where Nancy Stiles, the Hampton Republican, is leaving. An assortment of communities all along the Seacoast. Again, no major city, a lot of decent-sized suburbs. You see that a great deal. But all politics is local. Tip O'Neill was right. And you talk to the candidates running for governor, and what do they say in both parties? They essentially say it's these races that are going to drive turnout. They really believe, for example, with 8 Republican primaries, that the original model of, say, 105,000, 110,000 voters in a Republican primary may be short. Some Republican candidates for governor are operating on a model of, say, 125,000 to 130,000 voting in a Republican primary. Why? Because of those local elections, because there's somebody on the ballot running for a fairly high-profile position, state senate, who hasn't run before. I know this person. They've been a selectman. They've been a House member. I want to work for them. I want to plant a sign on my lawn, make some calls, and again, drive up that local turnout.
Mm-hmm. Senator Woodburn?
I came out of the newspaper world, and if you look at what we've lost on that and what has replaced it, was that process of balanced reporting is lost to social media, where the extremes and the energy and the criticisms are so much more raw and difficult. And I think they do force our politics to change in not a positive way, where I think the newspaper coverage forced people to the middle and social media forces it to the edges.
So it's having a polarizing effect. But let me ask you, Senator Bragdon, in your experience when you were in the chamber, did you feel like you were able to get the message out that people were listening, or do you just feel like the sort of the media apparatus is not there for the state legislature?
Well, I think the media has changed, and so earlier on it was a little easier to get the message out. There was more regional news coverage, and then that became less and less, and so you had to be more proactive yourself to really get a message out.
Dan?
And there's also filling that vacuum, so to speak. There, you have seen a rise in not only the partisan media, but partisan special interest groups that do their own outreach, that do their own, email newsletters, that do their rating of senators based on their perception of what a good or bad vote is. And that's another source of information that's available for people. But, you know, as we've said, it does not hew to that sort of traditional, objective local media that's part of a tradition of American democracy.
Mm-hmm. Kevin, let me follow up on something that Dan said earlier about the change in partisan control. One of the things we're following this time around, and we'll talk about it more a little bit later in the show, is this idea that, Democrats have an opportunity to take back control of the chamber from the Republicans. Is it your sense, having covered this for a while, that there have been more frequent changes in party control in recent decades? And if so, why do you think?
Yeah, certainly the Democrats, historically, the state Senate over a century has been a Republican-dominated body. When the Democratic Senate president in 1998, CUNY Blaisdell, took over, he was the first Democrat to run the Senate since 1912. So that gives you a perspective on the history. But certainly we've seen a couple of times Democrats take over this chamber. It's notable that – and we can talk about this later in the show – that this has always happened in a state election year. They've kept it in a presidential year, but they've always taken over in a state election year. We are in a presidential election year in which the party politics are dominated by the presidential race, and this one will be no different. But as we talked about at the onset of the show, with 6 of 8 vacancies being held by Republicans and the 2 Democratic vacancies being among the 2 most Democratic districts in the Senate, that gives the Democrats certainly a leg up. That means essentially that if we can win 2 of those 6 Republican vacant seats, then we're tied at 12-12. If we can win 3 out of 6, 50-50, we take over the body. Those are good numbers for a minority party, and that's a challenge for Republicans to defend. I will point out, I always think primaries are a great thing for political parties, and I think the Republicans are helped by the fact that there's some robust primaries here for some of these vacant seats. They tend to generate a lot of energy. The winner gets a big bump out of winning that primary, and it often helps that new candidate in a contested primary win election.
Want to jump in, Senator?
I would disagree with the wisdom that usually flows from Kevin Landrigan. In this case, I think what we're seeing, and I think it's played out best in the Medicaid expansion issue, which was the priority that Peter Bragdon, as well as the other reasonable moderate Republicans who can work across party lines, were able to accomplish. Because right now in the Republican primary, there tends to be a conservative, very conservative, and a more moderate conservative. And we're seeing this kind of civil war within the Republican primary. And if the more conservative candidate wins in a year where the Republican brand with Donald Trump at the top of the ticket is not strong, I've always think politics is about math, who is closest to the center. And I think our Democratic candidates come from the center. They're rooted in the community. And I think these contrast of who wins these Republican primaries, some of them will be so far out of the mainstream and in opposition to the basic principles of how do we expand Medicaid if the Republican majority, the vast majority of the Republicans, oppose it.
Senator Bragdon, I'm interested in your thoughts on this whole issue of, you know, swings in partisan control. Obviously, primaries are important, but, you know, you only have a 2-year term, unlike a U.S. senator where there's a little more kind of stability built in. What was that experience like?
Well, first, I guess I need to correct something that the almost always correct Senator Woodburn mentioned. I voted against Medicaid expansion. The first time it came up, and the second time I was conflicted by a job issue, so I didn't vote. So, but I will say that you know, even on those issues, I mean, it's the job of the minority leader to make it sound like the majority is going to be a bunch of crazy people. And when I first won a primary, you know, I was labeled the same way by the opposition. You know, the world was going to come to an end because Peter Bragdon, this far-right extreme guy, got elected. So I think that the voters in the districts are capable of sorting things out. A number of people who voted against Medicaid expansion the last time got reelected. So it's not a litmus test to the voters. I think the voters really take a broad look at all the candidates.
And we have to take a brief break here, but we're going to come back. There's lots more to talk about on the state Senate. We'll start talking about a number of the individual races as well. So stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Dean Spiliotis. Today on The Exchange, the races you may not have been paying attention to, those for the state Senate, but perhaps more impactful for New Hampshire than the presidential race in the end. You can call in at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can send us an email to exchange@nhpr.org, and you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And I have 4 guests with me in studio today. Jeff Woodburn is Minority Leader of the Senate Democratic Caucus. He represents District 1 in the North Country. It's the largest in the state. Kevin Landrigan is a senior reporter at the New Hampshire Union Leader. Peter Bragdon is a former Republican state Senate president from the 11th District. And Dan Barrick is NHPR senior policy and politics and editor. And gentlemen, let's continue on with our conversation, and then we'll start talking about some of the races. And Senator Bragdon, I want to come back to you briefly to talk a little bit about this issue of your experience with swings and partisan control.
Yeah, when I first got elected, the Republicans were in the majority, then we were in the minority, and then I became the minority leader, which is what Senator Woodburn is now, and I saw it as my goal to get that title changed, and I'm sure that's his goal as well. And yeah, it's pins and needles every 2 years because you just never know what's going to happen. I remember a phone call to Senator Larson, the Democratic leader in the Senate, about 11 o'clock on an election night when it looked like the Senate was going to be tied. Back in, that must have been 2012, I guess. Yep. And so, you know, you're always on pins and needles. And then at the last minute, a race ended up on the Republican side and we had the majority. So it's always an exciting time every 2 years because, yeah, you don't know what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm. And Dan, let's turn to you and start talking about some of these races. We have these eight races. And we should mention, you know, we use the word kind of people are retiring or vacating the seats. But some people are going on to run for other seats, correct?
That's right. Senator Jeanne Forrester from District 2 is running for the Republican nomination for governor. Senator Russell Prescott's running for executive council. A number of them are taking other jobs. Senator Little, who actually resigned a while ago, is now the banking commissioner. But you're right. So there's eight vacancies, so to speak. And as Kevin said, six of those are currently held by Republicans, two by Democrats. The two Democratic seats are pretty much as strongly Democratic as you can get in New Hampshire. And of those six Republican-held vacancies, a good number of them are really true swing districts. And if you look at the last presidential election, just to give us the closest benchmark, 2012, a number of those districts were won by very tight margins. District 16, held by David Booten, who's retiring, he won with just 49% of the vote 4 years ago. Senator Cataldo won with 51% of the vote. He's retiring. So, I mean, by nature, those swing districts are ones that we're going to be keeping an eye – those vacancies are keeping an eye on simply because the power of incumbency is not there. Voters have a fresh choice, and a number of them happen to be true marginal districts. There's also a number that are held by incumbents that have been really tightly contested in recent years, District 9 held by Senator Sanborn. So there's a number of ones where and I think the other interesting question, and Kevin alluded to this, is what is going to drive turnout? Traditionally, in presidential years, the top of the ticket has driven turnout. You know, we think of 2008 when President Obama was on the ballot, that high turnout driven by low, you know, infrequent voters or first-time voters. And it's a really big question whether in this presidential election in which there's, you know, how many voters will be driven to the polls to vote for or against Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton versus, as Kevin alluded to, how many might be driven by the fact that there's somebody from their town running for state Senate. And that could really sort of upturn the apple cart here in a lot of the outcomes of these races.
Yeah, Kevin, it is true that during in recent cycles, we get very different electorates showing up at the midterm versus presidential year, whether it's, you know, 2008 versus 2010, 2014, very different electorates, and that could have a big impact.
Yeah, it could have a big impact. I mean, it's important to know, too, having sat through a number of recounts where you learn a lot about voter behavior. I love going to recounts because you really see what voters are thinking. And one of the observations about the presidential election is that, yes, a third more voters show up at a typical presidential election than a state election. And just anecdotally, you see that, you know, as many as 1 in 4, 1 in 5 vote for president, vote for governor, maybe vote for U.S. Senate, and then leave the rest blank. You know, so a lot of these presidential voters don't play in this
field. And there's no straight ticket voting anymore. You can't pop one button.
Exactly. You can't make one mark and have it count all the way down the ballot like you used to. The Democrats successfully got rid of that, which clearly for decades, generations, was a Republican franchise, that making one mark and counting for every vote. Now you no longer have that.
Mm-hmm. And let me turn to the senators. Senator Woodburn, you're obviously right in the middle of this, but I'm also interested to hear what you think. Senator Bragdon, your kind of initial sense of sort of the electoral landscape for the state Senate.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, the bottom line is most incumbents win. There is a – we bend towards that advantage of name recognition and being able to help your constituents out. So having open seats in areas that are swing districts in a presidential election, because bigger turnout historically has been better for Democrats. And
well, certainly in recent
and
cycles,
that's,
yeah.
And that's why we encourage greater participation in the electoral process for all different types of people. And but, you know, I also think the quality of the candidate. These elections are won on the ground by centrist, reasonable candidates that want to expand opportunity, that are where the electorate is, not you know, running sort of against the where the electorate is. And I think that's where the things like Medicaid expansion, infrastructure investment, and I'm looking very carefully at how many of the Republican primary candidates signed the Koch brothers pledge, which essentially means no Medicaid expansion, no investment in infrastructure, no tax increases, and it really it prohibits them from negotiating and being an effective member of the Senate. So, I mean, that's what we're looking very closely at, is how the ideological breakup. And quite frankly, I believe that this is a movement away from that long tradition of bipartisan, moderate approach to solving problems, because most of the senators we lost were people that we were able to work with to get things done.
And I should mention, just for listeners, that this Koch brothers pledge you mentioned is this sort of 5-point plan that politicians are running for office all around the country are asked to sign, and it's you know, low taxes and control spending,
right,
oppose Obamacare, right to work. Yeah, it's sort of a conservative platform that you can choose to sign. When do we find out who has signed that?
Hopefully soon. I mean, but the Senate President and the Majority Leader cannot sign that pledge because of the Medicaid expansion. So there's been this sort of civil war over, will the Republican Party be a centrist party working with both sides, or will they be a party that is restrained by this out-of-state Koch brothers pledge?
And let me turn to you, Senator Bragdon. We know that you're retired, you've stepped away, and you're not quite
thankfully
in the center of it the way that Senator Woodburn is. But I'm interested to hear your thoughts about how things are shaping up.
Yeah, and first with regard to pledges, I mean, both sides, there's pledges on both sides. Every candidate gets pledges or questionnaire things from groups from ranging from far right to far left. And so, you know, Planned Parenthood has their own thing where they ask you a bunch of questions. Will you do this? Will you do that? So, I mean, that's in all but the word, a pledge. So I think both sides do that. So it's kind of a red herring to be throwing that in. And the question was
just your general sense of how the electoral landscape is shaping up in the Senate.
Yeah, so I do agree with Senator Woodburn on the issue of the swing districts where an incumbent has chosen not to run again is probably the most likely ones to be watched. There's a lot of power in incumbency, and you know, a very close district being an incumbent that served their constituents well usually does pretty good. So I think this year, with so many vacancies and several swing districts that are toss-ups, I think those are the ones that probably should be watched.
We're talking about the race for the state Senate today on The Exchange. You can call in at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can email exchange@NHPR and let us know what you're thinking about for these various races for control of the New Hampshire state Senate. And Dan, let me come back to you. And we talked a little bit earlier about kind of the professionalization of running for state Senate versus maybe running for House of Representatives. And we have an email from Larry in Dover, who says, I'm wondering how much outside money and influence, if any, is being exerted on the New Hampshire legislative races this cycle. Do we typically see, you know, Senator Woodburn mentioned the pledge from a national group, but are we seeing kind of the sort of national influence trickling down to that level?
Yeah, and you've seen that for quite a number of cycles, and it ebbs and flows with the competitiveness of the perceived competitiveness of the body as a whole, with whatever issues are out there nationally. I mean, one recent example is the group Emily's List, which is a Democratic-leaning – they support Democratic pro-choice on abortion female candidates. And they've targeted actually the New Hampshire Senate as among a handful of legislative bodies nationwide that they want to flip control of, to turn it to Democratic control for the stated purpose of maintaining that control through the next redistricting process. And they've identified and endorsed two Democratic candidates, Alexis Simpson in District 23 and Peggy Gilmore in the Nashua area, as candidates that they will be supporting, which is kind of remarkable that they're getting down to that granular level, identifying individual senators and individual districts that they're going to be supporting a national group with the stated goal of flipping majority control of the entire body for the purpose of redistricting. Rather administrative, but it could have real impacts on how voters in those districts, how that race plays out.
And Kevin, what are you seeing compared to what you've seen in the past?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I mean, because the landscape has changed dramatically over the last 20 years. I mean, what used to be a $20,000 state senate seat is now a $100,000 state senate seat. What used to be a $50,000 state senate seat now can be up to $200,000. I really credit Democratic Party Chairman Raymond Buckley with kind of helping change the paradigm here and bringing both parties into the present day. He'd like turned the Senate Democratic Caucus into this permanent fundraising machine that pays not only his salary but other staff at the Democratic Party. And dutiful candidates for state senate on the Democratic side, not all of them, but most of them, raise money and then turn it over to the caucus. They'll give as much as $50,000, $60,000, $70,000, $80,000 to the Senate Democratic caucus. And history has told us, particularly in those state elections, not presidential elections, it's money well spent because the money goes to the party and they control the message. They control the advertising, the mail, the signs, all the communications, the press work. Like I say, it's done well. The Republicans have stepped up their game in the last 10 years under Senate President Bragdon and now under Senate President Chuck Morse. Both very good fundraisers have sometimes matched and even overmatched what the Democrats have raised. So as a result, this is why Emily's List sees what's going on in New Hampshire and says, hey, we can play in that game because everybody's playing in this game. On the right, big pharma, big oil, big energy, big finance is playing that game. On the left, pro-abortion rights, pro-gay rights, all of these groups on the left are playing in this game and raising and contributing large sums of money.
And Senator Bragdon, I'm interested to hear if over time you notice kind of the financial requirements in running for state office. Did you feel a change while you were in office?
I didn't personally feel a change because my biggest struggles were in the early election cycles. And then once I established myself as a non-kooky Republican, despite the efforts of my friend Jeff Woodburn's party, I had relatively token opposition. And but from the broader perspective as Senate president and dealing with some of the PAC issues, it got escalated. And kind of my experience, too, the first time I ran for re-election, I was, planning a regular traditional campaign. And then my opponent was overheard bragging to a local Democratic town committee that the chairman of the state Democratic Party had committed to spending $100,000 to defeat me. So when I heard about that, I said, oops, guess it's time to start raising some money as well. So it increases year by year for sure.
Yeah, Senator Woodburn.
I would say anybody who has to raise lots of money for a caucus or for candidates supports campaign finance work because it is not something that we enjoy doing, but it is the hard work. I just want to make one important point.
Sure.
I think about the Emily's List is that the reason they are so committed because the fragile balance of abortion rights being the official position of the New Hampshire Senate for a long period of time with moderate pro-choice Republicans. In terms of the access to abortion clinics, which is really where the fight is today on the issue of abortion, there is no Republican left in the Senate who is truly pro-choice when it comes to those issues of access to clinics. So for our chamber to be able to be pro-choice, as it has been traditionally, the pathway is electing Democrats because of the nature of the change of the Republican Party to become more conservative than it has been in its history.
Well, it's interesting. Yeah, Dan, you want to follow up, and then I have a question.
I just also think it was interesting that Emily's List, one of the things that they noted was that they wanted to assist Democrats to hold control of the Senate during the redistricting process, which, as I said, is typically a fairly administrative, out of the headlines thing. But it's also a recognition of the increased, I think, politicization of things like redistricting. And just one other thing on the financing, we've looked at a lot of the financial. Personal fundraising for state Senate candidates over the year. In addition to just the bottom line number rising, there's been a big increase in the amount of self-funding. And I think the big question is what impact did that have on the self-selection of the types of candidates who can run, people who can write a check for themselves, who can finance their own campaign to a large extent and whether that's a barrier to entry.
That's interesting that you're seeing self-funding at that level. I mean, that's historically something you may occasionally see sort of wealthy, successful business people run for governor or U.S. senator, but it sounds like it's becoming increasingly common.
The bottom line is a lot lower than, you know, as Kevin said, you know, $100,000, $200,000 to run a state senate campaign versus a few million, but it's a fact.
And we really have to remind people that we make $100 a year.
That's right. Well, and I think, honestly, and Senator Bragdon, you can probably speak to this. A lot of people think it's a full time. It seems like a full time job, really. I mean, how do you weave in having a separate career?
Well, you can certainly make it a full time job. I will say the Senate President gets $125 a year. it's much more.
And mileage, right?
Mileage and free tolls.
That's good.
So, yeah, it definitely can be a full time job if you make it. I think in 2010, when the Republicans took control of the Senate back, we had 10 brand new senators. Or 10 of the new senators who had small businesses. And so I tried real hard as Senate President to make the schedule such that people could still do their jobs and serve in the state Senate. But in reality, it's very difficult to do that when the Senate's in session.
We're talking about the race for the state Senate today on The Exchange. You can call in at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. Maybe you have a question about who's running in your neck of the woods here in New Hampshire, but you can call in 1-800-892-6477. Email us exchange@nhpr.org. And Kevin, let me turn to you. We've mentioned already, and you may have mentioned it, District 24, which is the Nancy Stiles district, and also Senator Woodburn talking a little bit about the Republican Party's kind of ideological shift. Christopher emails us and he says, I think that Dan Innes is the kind of Republican best suited for Nancy Stiles District 24 seat. That is socially moderate and fiscally center right. I doubt he would have stood a chance had he run in the district of his former home, Portsmouth, which now, like Concord, hardly even fields a Republican candidate anymore. That's Christopher from Manchester. Your thoughts?
Yeah, that's a very contested primary. You got four Republicans there, and it does Senator Woodburn referred to this earlier. This is a race in which you've got really the spectrum of the Republican Party represented. You've got Steve Kenda from Northampton, a businessman who once thought about running for governor. Very conservative, social conservatives as well. Ray Tweedy from Rye, a former selectman who's there, who has been endorsed by Nancy Stiles, the reigning Republican senator, who's a moderate Republican. Dan Innes, who ran for Congress, thought about running for Congress a second time and decided not to run. And Jim McGorry in Northampton. As I say, it's been a very aggressive race now. I think you'd really have to say Tweedy, who's got the endorsement of Stiles, and Innes are probably the favorites in that race. But Kenda is a self-funder. He's someone who can spend a lot of money. We haven't seen him spend it as well. But the sharp elbows have already started up.
You're seeing aggressive mailers in this race
that were sponsored by a super PAC that have ties to Dan Innes, and they have a super PAC that supported Dan Innes' congressional run. Innes says that raised questions about Tweedy, mentioned the fact he'd had a couple of DWIs in his past, that he'd been removed from local bodies. Tweedy has acknowledged that in published interviews before.
And sent out some aggressive sort of counter mailers. I mean,
exactly.
You're seeing this back and forth,
yes,
at a small level that you would typically see in a congressional race.
Right.
And we need to take one more break, but coming up, we'll talk more about the issues and candidates that are involved in the race for the New Hampshire State Senate. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Dean Spiliotis. Today, 8 seats are up for grabs in the state Senate, possibly changing the face of the New Hampshire legislature. Let's hear from you. You can call in at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can email us, exchange@nhpr.org, and you can find us on Facebook and Twitter. I have 4 guests with me in studio for the remainder of the show. Peter Bragdon is a former Republican state Senate president from the 11th District. Kevin Landrigan is a senior reporter at the New Hampshire Union Leader. Jeff Woodburn is minority leader of the Senate Democratic Caucus representing District 1 in the North Country. And Dan Barrick is NHPR's senior policy and politics editor. And Dan, let me turn to you and continue our discussion of kind of key races. There are a few other ones we want to point out here.
Yeah, the open seats, the seats with the retiring senators are not the only ones that that are getting attention. There's a number, District 12, which includes a small slice of Nashua and several western suburbs, currently held by Senator Avard, a Republican, is actually the Democratic challenger, Peggy Gilmore, has actually held that seat a couple times. I think that seat's gone back and forth between Democrats and Republicans every election for the past four or so. And it's I know we'll get to this later, but it's an interesting byproduct of the redistricting process. It used to be a very strongly Democratic seat focused on Nashua. It's now just got a slice of Nashua and several Republican-leaning suburbs. District 8 was held by Senator Little, who's now the banking commissioner, for the last several – it was a long time held by Bob O'Dell, a moderate Republican. Democrats feel very good about their candidate in that district, and I think the demographics of it make it a very open seat. So there's a number of beyond just these open districts, which we've been focusing on, that will be quite active.
Senator Woodburn, your thoughts?
Well, first of all, I think that the redistricting process has been involved in the political process, and the Democrats in the Senate have supported a nonpartisan approach to try to do this. When you add up all the votes across all the elections in 2012, there were more Democratic votes than Republicans, yet they were in the wrong places.
The big redistricting, just for listeners, was pretty recently, right?
2011.
Okay. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So I think the hope is we should be – the goal should be competitive seats that produces the best democracy. We see that this election really being on those that can work together with people to get bipartisan solutions. And when you see this schism between the Republican leadership, the Senate president, majority leader, and the rest of the Republican candidates on issues like Medicaid expansion, do we keep the gas tax, which is in making improvements in our infrastructure, and various other issues that are – we've worked together to find common sense solutions. How do we preserve that centrist approach of the Senate that has worked so well in a time where the Republican Party has really gone so far to the right, they're unwilling to compromise and, quite frankly, challenge anyone who supported Medicaid expansion? That has been the approach, and that is, quite frankly, why a lot of Republicans have left the Senate. The long hours, the extended session that we had, both in the budget and the opiate issue, but also just being harassed at home by the more conservative Republican base.
Oh, and Senator Bragdon, you were there during the Senate president, I believe, during the redistricting,
yep.
Correct?
Yeah. Well, and I'll point out that this redistricting is made to sound like the worst thing that ever happened. I'll point out that Governor Lynch signed the redistricting bill. He vetoed the House bill. He could have let the Senate one go through without his signature, but he signed it. So, it wasn't as bad as everybody makes it sound. I think some of these elections that don't have incumbents will kind of show what's going on. But I do need to take issue with what Senator Woodman just said about how it's we all work together, blah, blah, blah. If you look at the historic voting within the Senate, you'll find that it's the Republicans that are willing to compromise and the Democrats never willing to compromise. One of the stats I kept from all the voting records was partisan voting. Basically, if all the Republicans vote one way and all the Democrats vote the other way, who's willing to switch sides? And of the Democrats, three of them voted with the Republicans 10% or more of the time. All the others voted less than 10%, including Governor Haslam. She was in the Senate. It was less than 1% of the time she crossed over to vote with Republicans, whereas Republicans, I think only three didn't vote across party lines more than 10% of the time. So it's the Democrats who aren't willing to compromise. The Republicans have compromised on various things. But the data shows that the partisan nature of the Senate, the Democrats are more partisan and stick together more so than the Republicans.
I just say this is not about statistics. It's about getting things done that are meaningful. The reason why Medicaid expansion passed was because it's popular and it was a good program that cost New Hampshire nothing and 50,000 people get health care today. And that is why Republicans joined us. We passed the gas tax because people realized that we needed to make an investment. We could not let our infrastructure continue to decline. These are kind of things that are populist ideas that in many cases the Republicans are holding on to an unpopular ideology, and that is why more moderate Republicans join with the Democrats to be able to pass progressive legislation. And I don't think we can go forward as a state with a very conservative Republican Party that is at odds with Chuck Morse and Jeb Bradley and be successful at being able to do these progressive, moderate, reasonable things.
Well, Kevin, let me bring you in.
I just wanted to say that redistricting is all about party politics and the party that's in power. Democrats have held control of the Senate, but the fact is they've never had control when it came time to drawing up the maps. That makes all the difference and why right now, there are more solidly Republican districts than there are solidly Democratic districts. Why did the redistricting map pass 19-4 in the state Senate at that time, as Peter Bragdon referred to when the governor signed it? The reason is it took care of incumbents. Every Democratic incumbent who was in the Senate, right, with the exception of one we'll talk about, yeah, had a more Democratic district than they had before redistricting. Yeah. The only difference was some of the swing districts became more Republican districts. That's kind of the dirty little secret here we talk about, is there's 20 – in both parties, we won't talk about in public. There's 24 state Senate districts. There's only like 8 or 9 that are competitive.
Right.
The other 15 or 16 are very solidly Republican or very solidly Democratic. And it's up to both political parties. And I think, frankly, both parties this time have done an excellent job of finding the best candidates for those seats that are swing districts. And we've seen that, like I said, with both parties, done a good job.
Yeah, Kevin's absolutely right about just the increasingly safe nature of a lot of these districts. And you can see it not only just by looking at the elections within those districts for Senate candidates, but you know, we've looked at the numbers. If you take the presidential level votes, you go back 20 years, there were very few state Senate districts. If you look at the outcome of the presidential election within those districts, there was only a handful, 2 or 3, that varied significantly from the statewide, meaning most Senate districts were roughly close to the statewide partisan breakdown. Now, there's very few districts that are actually close to the center. I mean, New Hampshire still is a swing state in presidential elections. That, in other words, part of that is fueled by natural demographic shifts. But a large part of it is, as Kevin said, political decisions made by incumbents about how they want their lines to look. And it's a bipartisan, you know, the opportunity for bipartisan affairs there is real.
Yeah, I can bring both senators
but
back
only
in again, yeah.
One party supported a nonpartisan independent council that said the focus should be making each seat as competitive as possible, so every senator, every Senate candidate has to work hard to appeal to their constituencies. Leaving them uncontested or essentially uncontested is not good for either party. It's not good for democracy.
Well, and the experience with independent redistricting commissions shows that they end up in the same kind of swamp that happens anyways with the political makeup. And when all is said and done, a redistricting plan has to be passed by the body. And people are going to look at what's happening in their district first, and is their district staying contiguous and groups of interest kept together. And you've got to get 13 votes. Everything in the Senate is a math equation. You got to get 13 votes.
Yeah, I was just going to say, let's look at Maggie Hassan's old Senate district. Let's just take that as one example and how redistricting changed that and why Senator Hassan made a wise move running for governor in 2012 and getting elected governor. Because after redistricting, what came out of her district? Newfields, where she now lives, came out of her district, Democratic town. Newmarket. Democratic town. Kensington, very leaning, can be very moderate town. What went in? Brentwood, Chester, Danville. I mean, rock-ribbed, very Republican towns. Alexa Simpson, very good candidate, but running against the tide in that district. Can she win? It's possible. But that district is a much less level playing field than it was before redistricting. And the same is true on the Democratic side. I mean, in the Upper Valley district that Dave Pierce is leaving, used to be represented by moderate Republicans before. There's no Republican going to win that district the way it's constituted right now.
Dan, let me turn to you. This, listening to Kevin and the senators talk about the various districts in the towns, we had an email from Bill from West Deering basically trying to figure out how to learn about all this. He says, I've seen the sample ballots for the upcoming elections, and he says, who the heck are all these people? You know, he's wondering, are they libertarians, free staters? You've done a lot of reporting on this. What's the best way to go about learning about a lot of the things that Kevin's talking about and the candidates, et cetera?
Well, it's a good question. It's going to vary significantly by where you live in the state. It's going to vary by how aggressive your local media is. It's going to vary by how much outreach the individual candidate's doing. You know, sophisticated candidates have websites or Facebook pages that detail their positions. A lot of the local papers will do editorial boards where they'll call the candidates in and walk them through their position on taxes and healthcare and education. But there's, we were doing reporting on some of the districts. But, I mean, I do think bottom line, it points to the paucity of good objective data about, what will be in a month 48 individual candidates running, two candidates for each party for those 24 seats. So it varies significantly in a place like Manchester. You've got three districts that touch Manchester. You've got a large newspaper that will bring them all in for editorial boards. But I'm assuming Senator Woodburn could probably talk about. He represents a large district, sparsely populated, largely rural. The media market there is probably not as aggressive as say in Manchester or Concord or the Seacoast.
And Senator Woodburn, you were a Democratic Party chair at one point as well, correct?
Correct.
So what is the sort of coordination at the level of the state Senate in terms of getting information on the candidates out?
Well, I think that has been part of the problem. I mean, I think primaries, on the Republican side will certainly they'll have that fight about who's with Trump, who's against Trump. Where they stand on some of those issues. But social media, the presence of the media is not where it was. The number of radio stations in New Hampshire where we used to have really endless amount of forums on these discussions does not exist. And, it really is the candidates going out and knocking on doors and paid voter contact. And that's what is going to drive the election and drive the process here.
Senator Bragdon, do you think that Donald Trump poses an issue or a challenge for these candidates, or are people just voting on other criteria when they choose their state senators?
Yeah, I don't think it particularly matters. I do think the mood of the voters in a national election does affect the state. And, back in 2000, was it 6 or 8, both 6 and 8, the mood of the voters was, boy, those Republicans in Washington really screwed us. We're mad at all of them. I don't think that's the case now. I think both major candidates in the presidential parties, are not really all that popular. Mm-hmm. And so there's not that partisan mood. It's a dislike. So I think it will scatter as it gets down the ballot. And I don't think it'll have as big an impact as it did in prior years.
Kevin, what's been your experience in terms of the relationship between running for state senate and all the other up-ticket ballots?
Yeah, it can have an impact, but like I said earlier in the show, I mean, all politics is local. And I've really felt that we've seen the significant changes we have seen in the state Senate over the years because of there's down ballot impact, but it's really about the state races above that ballot. I mean, when did the Democrats take control of the state Senate in 2006 and why? John Lynch got over 70% of the vote running for reelection against a weak Republican. I mean, when did Republicans take it back? They took it back when Kelly Ayotte almost beat Congressman Paul Hodes almost 2-1 in the U.S. Senate.
And you have the 2006 was the Democratic tsunami nationally, and 2010 is the Tea Party. So, Dan, there are these kind of national connections.
When the Democrats first won the Senate in 1998, I was Democratic Party chair, and Jean Shaheen was governor, and she made it a point that she went into districts, she coordinated message and said, we need to be talking about things like minimum wage and issues that matter to people. And sometimes candidates get too localized and talk about their experience in the school board or whatever issues, but to really be in focus what's on the voters' mind. This is about people, not about process or elections or statistics. It's about what's on their mind, and communicating effectively to those issues is what's important.
Dan, and that gets at another big unknown that's kind of in the shadows here, which is we don't know who's going to be governor next year. We don't even know what party they're going to be from. So none of these candidates can say, send me to Concord to work well with Governor Hassan or Governor Lynch or whoever. So this just adds to the uncertainty surrounding what's going to be happening in the State House next year.
Yeah. Senator Bradley, I'm interested in your thoughts on all this.
I'm sorry.
Let's start with the 2010, the Tea Party rebellion. Then you essentially become Senate president in 2011. Right?
Goes back to the mood of the voters. And in 2010, it was a lot of dislike of what was going on in Washington this time with the Democrats and the Tea Party movement and everything else. So it switched from being mad at Bush and the Republicans to being mad at Obama and the Democrats. And I just don't see this year as that big a thing. This year it seems to be damn those incumbents. And so everybody better watch out, I guess. So,
the one issue is if you read the newspapers and listen to the radio, what you hear too often is I'm endorsing Trump, I'm supporting Trump, I'm disavowing Trump. And that is a reaction. Plus, just Trump is taking all of the energy out of the room. And that means Republicans can't talk about their agenda and their reasons for running. And it does block that out. And I think it does have the potential impact of suppressing some of the Republican vote that are just not the right wing, who just may not be excited about Trump or others like Gordon Humphrey and other prominent leaders who've said, hey, I can't support this person. Will they some of them not come at all, or how will they behave when they do come?
Hey, Kevin, we each have a brief amount of time left. Sure. The sort of Trump issue aside, what kinds of issues are you looking for to kind of dominate the state Senate electoral discourse?
Well, certainly Medicaid expansion will, the state budget will. Social issues often dominate the Senate in an election year. Things like decriminalizing marijuana, casino gambling. I think the transgender discrimination issue will emerge back in New Hampshire. New Hampshire was leading the country when the New Hampshire House approved it. It was then rejected 24-0 in the Senate. I should say, as we conclude, these five white guys should note that the state Senate has been a place that has promoted women. The state Senate was a place where, in 2008, made history, the first legislative body where there was a female majority. We've had female leaders in the Senate who've been Senate presidents. We have a Jeanne Forrester, the Senate Finance Chairwoman on the Republican side, a serious candidate for governor. I think that's one of the lasting legacies of the Senate. Mm-hmm.
And as you can hear, we are out of time. I'd like to thank all of my guests for a very lively discussion today. Senator Bragdon, Senator Woodburn, Dan Barrick, and Kevin Landrigan, thank you all so much. And Dan, you'll be doing more reporting on this, correct, in the coming months?
Yeah, through Election Day. You can find it at NHPR.org.
And remember, the conversation always continues online, on Facebook, and on NHPR.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producer is Jessica Hunt. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm, and our intern is Sam Ruthier. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, sitting in for Laura Kanoye.